everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. It's time for It's All About Food, where we get to talk about my favorite subject, food, and all different aspects of food and our food system. Delicious and nutritious, sometimes happy, sometimes sad. We cover it all. Before I get to my first guest, I wanted to let you know, if you don't know already, that my friend and colleague, Dr. Michael Greger, has come out with another wonderful book. It was released today. It's called How Not to Diet. How Not to Diet. You may remember his last book was called How Not to Die. And that was an interesting title that a lot of us got to discuss. And his books are always loaded with all kinds of resources and references, humor, and serious information. I haven't read it yet, but I will. It includes cutting-edge science behind long-term weight loss success. And you can find out more at his website, nutritionfacts.org. It's right there on the homepage. Okay, that's Dr. Michael Greger. How Not to Diet. Very good. Okay, my first guest is Ben Wergaft, and he has a book that came out recently called Meat Planet, Artificial Flesh, and the Future of Food. Benjamin Aldez Wergaft is a writer and historian and currently a visiting scholar in anthropology at MIT. He was a National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellow at MIT and a Mellon postdoctoral fellow at the New School for Social Research. His essays on food and other topics appear regularly in publications from Gastronomica to the Los Angeles Review of Books to the Hedgehog Review. And thank you for joining me, Benjamin.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And I find myself currently a visiting professor at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, not so far from New York. So my path continues to wind, and I'm delighted to be here to talk with you about the wild world of efforts to grow meat in laboratories.
It is indeed wild, and I've been reading a lot of meaty books lately. I have to be careful about that word meat. There are some people that don't want us to use it in reference to things that aren't from an animal. But this book, like some others I've been reading lately, is very dense and full of lots of information, and there are many things I would like to cover, and we don't have the time for that. So we're just going to step through lightly a little bit on your journey with cultured meat. And it's a really interesting book where you pull from philosophers and history and data and science, a lot of things that I don't normally see in the kind of food books that I read. So it was indeed interesting and fascinating. I understand in the description of the book that this is a neutral space. You took a somewhat neutral position, and we can talk about that. I found myself knee-jerking a bit because I'm not in a neutral space. I have very strong opinions. But I'm glad that you hit on a wide range of things and a wide range of opinions.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction. I find myself aware of the fact that many of your listeners will have a varying level of awareness of what cultured meat is, and I don't want to presume too much familiarity. So would it be helpful if I started by saying a little bit about what this possible food of the future is?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, so tissue culture, that is to say, growing cells in some form of growth medium under glass, so it's usually called in vitro, which in Latin means under glass. Tissue culture techniques have been around for over 100 years. An embryologist named Ross Harrison first grew cells under glass successfully in 1907. It's only for the past 20 years or so that practical efforts to try to take animal muscle cells and place them in a growth medium and grow them into something that can be used as food have been underway. So the world of cultured meat research is quite young by the standards of the development of new technologies. At present, as of very late 2019, there are no cultured meat products on the market. It's important not to mix them up with the world of very similar kinds of innovations, the so-called tech burgers, the Impossible and Beyond Meat burgers, which are plant-based and often based on pea protein, although I believe that Beyond has a soy component as well. I'm not quite sure about that. But the focus of my book is on a technology that some people hope will emerge and reach the mass market relatively soon, cutting into the production of meat by conventional means. That is to say, the in vivo growth of meat on animal bodies in the industrial animal agriculture system. Now, there are two reasons to want to do this, or two main reasons, actually quite a few reasons. One of them is the environmental footprint of conventional animal agriculture. Estimates for the percentage of our civilization's annual greenhouse gas emissions that come from this are 14 to 18%. And the other, of course, has to do with what you might call the moral footprint of treating billions of animals, frankly, quite poorly in our food system each year. Now, I don't agree with many claims that are made on behalf of cultured meat, although I'm a proponent of cultured meat research. The one thing that I certainly agree on wholeheartedly is that the problems of industrial animal agriculture do need to be addressed. The book is not a work of advocacy or criticism. I don't consider myself neutral per se, but I'm careful to sort of situate myself. I'm an omnivore, and I am not an activist. And I have sometimes notes of agreement to sound with the advocates of cultured meat, and sometimes notes of dissonance and criticism, depending on the claims that are being made. And the way in which I'm sort of most different from them, I think, is that my book doesn't embrace the premise that we even understand the problem of meat very well. And it tries to, if you imagine somebody giving a talk at a tech conference, like the TED conference, on behalf of cultured meat, and they're up on stage and they're telling you how this is going to save the world, my book sort of does a freeze frame on that moment and zooms out and says, really? And asks that question really about many, many things, including our ability to know anything meaningful about the future of food.
Okay, that was a very good summary and explanation of cultured meat and your approach in your book. I've made lots of little notes, and I thought we might touch on some of them. I have to say, I'm not neutral. I'm a vegan for 31 years, and I do consider myself an activist. And I want to support everything that gets us away from causing pain and suffering to humans and non-humans. That means the environment, that means animals, that means us. And if cultured meat can aid in that progression, then I will support it. I have some other issues related to it. Maybe we'll get to that later in the program. Just some interesting things that I made notes of. A big issue here related to cultured meat specifically is capitalism. And things don't progress in our civilization unless they're connected to profit. That's the nature of capitalism. So we don't necessarily make the best choices for society because capitalism is not based on ideal sources or ideal things for society. It's based on shareholder profit. And so cultured meat seems sexy right now. I'm thinking of, I was talking with a friend recently, a professor at Columbia, and he was talking about how the infrastructure of our cities are really falling apart, but nobody wants to really support plumbing and pipes, and investors, they don't want to put their name on a pipe project. It's not really a sexy thing to do. You also mentioned that some of the cultured meat science comes from the medical world, and that maybe this is another way to make more profit from something that isn't working out as well as the investors would have liked, as quickly as they would have liked. So maybe you can expand on some of that.
Oh, well, these are both very interesting places to start. And the first one is that, you know, you're talking about a conversation with a friend, and the friend says, well, we don't fix things. And my inference is that we don't like to do fixing and maintaining work because it's not perceived as sexy. It's not charismatic. I wouldn't assume that you would want to fund the Karen Hart Glass renovation of the 145th Street sewer line.
Exactly.
Like, it's hard to get a naming opportunity, as they say in the giving world, around a renovation project. And it would be wonderful for the aging infrastructure of our cities if we could do that. But this is, of course, as you implied, really relevant to the world of laboratory-grown meat, because the problems that it seeks to fix are structural, much like the aging infrastructure of our cities, structural problem. And structural problems are, by their nature, big in scale and hard to fix, multi-causal, and it's often much more appealing to simply say, and maybe this was your point, it's more appealing to say, here's a new widget, and by applying that widget to this system, we can fix the problem. But if the problem isn't industrial scale meat production itself, but rather, you know, if Thomas Robert Malthus was right in the 1798 essay on the principle of population, if it was really our propensities to consume and reproduce too much, to outstrip production in the ways that we do, and to want to fix the problem with more growth, then we have a stickier issue than simply what meat is made of and how we get meat. Almost everybody in the cultured meat world, myself included actually, would quite like it if everybody simply stopped eating animals, if we just stopped wanting to. And the premises of cultured meat are that that is a fairy tale, that that's a kind of a fantasy. And one of the social forces that's driven cultured meat in very recent years is the movement of a lot of talent from the world of animal protection activism to the world of promoting meat surrogates. And the tacit claim driving that move is that technology and the market are a more effective way of changing things than activism and organizing. When I ask questions about that, I'm usually told that I'm simply being idealistic and unreasonable, that things are, as you said earlier, that in fact, the only reason anything ever happens is because of profit motive. Now, of course, we both know that that's not entirely the case, It's easy to see how somebody could defend cultured meat and say they're simply being pragmatic, that we should expect change to only come through the aggregate behavior of consumers buying a new thing. However, you know, the scholar in me looks at that and sees not a truth claim, not an accurate truth claim, but a theory of change. I'm a historian by training. and I'm familiar, I'm always being exposed to theories of change. But there are always other ways for things to change than the one you've been exposed to already. And I just wanted to sort of footnote that. That's only part of what you were saying. I mean, it seems as though cultured meat entered into this sort of new phase we've seen at a very interesting moment, a moment when Obama was president in this country. Enthusiasm about Silicon Valley hadn't worn off quite as much as it had in the wake of the 2016 election and the burst of the bubble around the big tech companies. The belief that the combination of investment capital and good intentions could really change the world, in that classic TED Talky phrase. And it was in that particular cultural and economic climate that sort of capitalist philanthropic projects seemed like a good way to have traction on the world, at least for a certain kind of person. And I think that Cultured Meat got a lot of steam under it, really got up and running towards its subsequent overtaking by the startup culture in that moment. So in other words, none of this is, if you'll pardon the pun, none of this is outside of culture. much as markets themselves are cultural and political entities.
Absolutely. So you have lots of interesting chapters: meat, promise, fog, doubt, hope, tree, future, Prometheus, memento,
there was going to be one called lawsuit, but I ended up not being sued.
What was that?
Oh, there was going to be one called lawsuit, but I ended up not being sued.
Were you planning on being sued?
I think that in an environment like this one, you always think about it. I'm sorry to interrupt you, please.
Yeah, that's funny. So chapter 11, I like that phrase, chapter 11, is entitled Copy. And I have a nonprofit. It's called Responsible Eating and Living. And what we do in this nonprofit is we promote a healthy plant diet, whole foods, organic, minimally processed, that sort of thing. And so I thought this particular chapter piqued my interest, where people are concerned that this cultured meat isn't real. And for lots of different reasons, people have romantic reasons about raising an animal and eating a real animal rather than cultured meat. It's kind of crazy. But we live in a world filled with industrial food today. I don't even think people know what's in their food and know that so many artificial ingredients and flavorings are also not real.
Well, what's real?
What is real?
Well, no, I'm not asking the question to be annoying. I mean, of course, there's a small pleasure in being annoying, but I don't intend that now. we say something's unnatural, but that's always a complicated conversation. And the idea, and there's a wonderful food historian named Rachel Loudon, whose work I would so encourage you to look at. She's fantastic. And one of the things she's interested in is the way in which people have debates about what's natural and what isn't. And one of the arguments that Rachel rolls out all the time is that people don't ask questions about natural and artificial in neutral ways. They ask them in value-laden ways. They ask them in the context of getting other people to try to do something or another thing. Sometimes for good reasons. I'm not saying that it's bad to try to convince people of things. Simply saying that the idea of natural and unnatural gets complicated and is hard to look at. Is a tomato grown organically in your backyard from seeds you got at a swap 10 miles from your house natural? And if I told you that seed was the product of 1,000 tomato generations of plant breeding by humans, would that make it less natural? And what's the difference between that? Just asking the question, and the modification of a tomato plant through laboratory techniques that affect its germline. And there obviously is a big difference. It's not that one thing is, it's not that they're both equally unnatural. It's just the line between one kind of modification by breeding and another by lab technique, it can be hard for people to see, and people's level of general education, as you said, about what's in their food, can be very bad. About 20 years ago, a survey in the EU asked people, I think they were at farmers markets, but I may be making that part up, do you know that there are genes in your food? And some people got very upset. Genes in my food. I hear that makes it a genetically modified organism. But in fact, I hope that there are genes in my food.
Yeah, and bacteria and all kinds of things. And chemicals.
Yeah. Well, and obviously, this, none of this is intended to exonerate industrial and highly processed food. Many problems associated with it. Either you or I could rattle them off for hours. It's simply to say that the conversation's tricky.
It is very tricky. Well, what I would like to see is, at the very minimum, that industrial food, the kind of food that people eat because they don't care or they don't have access to anything else, whatever the reason, that industrial food can be made from plants and not from animals, made in a lab and not from animals. And we're starting to see that. You mentioned number of companies. We have Just, which used to be Hampton Creek, and they have their egg product. And wouldn't it be great if all the industrial foods that used eggs could be replaced with a product like this? I mean, I love that concept. At the same time, I come from a place, I do have hope, and I would like to think that we can get to a place where people are eating a lot less meat, are more informed about their food choices. And what's frustrating to me is the amount of money and investment that goes into not only cultured meat, but these other plant-based meats like Beyond Burger and Impossible, rather than educating everybody about the best choices that we could make for food, which in my opinion are organic, whole, minimally processed plant foods. And I believe we can do that through education. And of course, we need the government on our side, and a lot of things can move that forward, but we don't do that. And I continually ask myself why. I mean, you have in the book where you were talking about being on stage with Andres Forgex in the Food Fight, an in-depth look at cultured meat event. You talk about numerous events that you witnessed or were a part of, and you ask the question if cultured meat reflects a cynical attitude regarding human nature, because it seems to place more confidence in tissue engineering than our capacity to rein in our appetite for meat. And his response was, it would be wonderful if everyone in this world became a vegetarian or vegan, but it's unrealistic. Why is it unrealistic? And you could speak from your own point of view, because you're an omnivore.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that being an omnivore gives me an omnivorous point of view. I don't think it's good that I'm an omnivore, by the way. I think it would be good if I stopped being an omnivore. But I also don't place a lot of stock in improving myself morally in that way. Or let me put it differently. I do, but I always, I'm skeptical of the idea that I might perfect my condition morally by such means. And I'm simply probably not the kind of person who works at that part of my moral character, for better and for worse. Let's look at Andras's claim, and it's an assertion. You know, we'd say that there are arguments and there are assertions, and when you're making an argument, you give your reasons. You state some facts that you think justify what you're saying. When you assert, you simply say, capitalism's bad, communism's bad. You know, you simply assert things. I think that what he's saying.
Do we have a few more hours? No.
What he was saying, no. What he was saying in 2014 was, you simply can't expect people to give up what they see as the normal pleasures of their, in many respects, difficult, hard, and dissatisfying lives, which for the majority of human persons remains cheap meat.
Yeah.
Since we're we have a minority vegetarian or vegan population, and he is simply trying to say, at the time that his company doesn't work on meat anymore at all. They work on leather, sort of copies of leather things. But what he was basically trying to say is, don't wait around for that. It's not going to happen, kid. And I don't think that's necessarily true, but the mechanisms by which change in that area might happen are multiple and hard to predict and hard to make certain claims about. We've had lots of vegetarian social movements fail to convert the numbers that they might like. We've had reasoned arguments from utilitarians like Peter Singer, who, you know, has, even though he's been incredibly influential for a philosopher, still feels as though his book didn't have the effect he wanted it to. He simply wanted people to agree with him and stop eating animals. by every reasonable standard, a limited meat diet or a non-meat diet's better. Better for the planet, better, seemingly better for us. Certainly better for animals. We live in a grotesquely unbalanced world in which the animal biomass of the planet is primarily agricultural. The presence of non-agricultural, non-domesticated species on the planet, of, say, mammals at least, could be called decorative.
To be called what?
Terms at this point. Decorative. That is to say, the number of elephants, tigers, egrets, if you leave insects out of the picture, the number of species on the planet that aren't us or things we use agriculturally could be called decorative, simply because of what we've done to the planet. And I do think that that's terrible. I do think there are too many of us. Although I'm not per se a Malthusian. But I think that the problem with Andras's claim is that it's hard to test in either direction. And the world of conversations about how we should eat in the future is full of untestable claims. And as a scholar of philosophy and as somebody who cares about the history of science, untestable claims make me antsy. They make me curious, but they also make me very uncomfortable when people ask me to change my behavior on the basis of an untestable claim.
You mentioned insects, and there is a section where you talk about eating insects, eating grasshoppers, and there's a whole lot of curiosity now about getting our protein from insects. We don't really have that much time to get into it, but it was just another issue for me where I'm thinking we have already all of these wonderful plant-based protein sources. Why do we have to exploit more animal species?
Yeah.
But that's what we do.
Yeah. I'm sympathetic. Look, I'm actually entirely sympathetic to that. I think that there are ways of eating meat that make me not unhappy, that make me less unhappy, shall we say? And an example of it, if I can impose on your vegan patients for a moment, would be to have a large number of people eat a small amount of an animal's flesh over a longer period of time. So, if you can imagine a pasta sauce with a little meat in it shared among a large group of people. So that each person is eating maybe just a tablespoon of meat I think that that's a much more, I think meat should be a condiment, not a main.
Well, it would definitely be better than it is today.
I really appreciate your interest in the book, and I hope that listeners will read it and read other books like it and think about the definition of meat, what the definition of meat might be, and whether or not it can change.
I just wanted to mention, I appreciated when you were talking about terroir, which is the different locations that have different kinds of soil that are fed and nourished in different ways, and as a result, we get different flavors in our foods. People may be familiar more with terroir when it comes to speaking about wines, for example, but then you came up with the word merroir. I appreciated that.
Oh, well, the possibility for wordplay and punning is one of the things that keeps me writing. But there is, you know, the world of people who like shellfish, those people are well familiar with merroir. thank you so much again. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Okay, thank you for joining me today, Ben Wirgaff, the author of Meat Planet, Artificial Flesh, and the Future of Food. Okay, let's move to my next guest. We have Eileen Godofsky-Moreno, the author of a new cookbook, The Colorful Family Table, Seasonal Plant-Based Recipes for the Whole Family. Hi, Eileen, how are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I was just talking with Benjamin Wirgaff. I don't know if you heard any of that interview. His book is intelligent, it's dense, it touches on a lot of aspects of our meat culture. And there are many investors today that are looking for new ideas and businesses to invest in and support. And a lot of them are related to either making plant-based meats or other plant-based products that are like animal products, and as well as cultured meat, which we just spoke about. Personally, I think we need more people like you that are putting together whole, minimally processed plant foods in beautiful, nutritious, and delicious ways. We need to be cooking for people and putting these things in their mouth and knowing, letting people know that nature has already provided us with so many different, wonderful, colorful foods that not only are delicious, but are the best things for our health and for the planet. And in the last segment, I didn't even have time to touch on the health, because if people are interested in eating cultured meat because they like to eat meat, we have no idea how that's going to impact our health. We already know about how animals negatively impact our health today. And I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about that before, but I just wanted to get that out. Anyway, so I appreciate everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much. I would say I don't know what the future holds with the meat substitutes and the plant-based meats and whatnot, and all of that's growing, but the foods that have been growing on this planet for thousands and thousands of years are there, and they're delicious, and I agree. I think that there's already so much delicious food that we can go find at the farmer's market. I would encourage people to just get, you know, start with their colors, as, you know, the title of my book says.
I wanted to say that the thing that I love the most about your book were the adorable little pictures of your older daughter that you call Baby V. When I was little, I have natural curly red hair. I was trying to think of what that cartoon character said in the Peanuts, Charlie Brown thing. Anyway, I have naturally curly red hair, and I kind of looked like her when I was little.
Oh,
those little tosses of red hair. So I appreciated pictures of her in the book.
Oh, yeah, she's a cutie.
And I also wanted to say that there's a lot of creativity in this book, and I feel like, this is the kind of food that I eat. This is the kind of food that I make, and I appreciated thumbing through it because I got some new ideas on how to use my same favorite ingredients that are fabulous. And I started to dog ear the recipes that I wanted to point out, and then I was like, the whole book was dog eared. So
oh my gosh, I love that.
But we can talk about a few. So when you're raising a family, I don't know, I don't have children, but I talk to a lot of people who do, and it's so challenging, especially in today's world where there's so many different influences. I was just talking last week to Bettina Elias Siegel, who just wrote a book called Kid Food, and there's so much out there, and it's incredible what's out there that's approved by our government that is so dangerous for our children.
Yeah, it's really scary to look at ingredients on many of the foods that are the basis of a lot of kids' diets.
It's scary. And so you have a lot of work to do. And as I mentioned briefly with my last guest, the importance of education and training, and it needs to start young, where as babies and toddlers and young children, we are fed whole, minimally processed, nutritious foods and learn along the way and help to prepare them and why they're important. And that's why what you're doing is so important. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think just starting young, I have my girls in the kitchen with me. It's not always the easiest thing in the world, but I think it's really important for them to see the sweet potato when I'm scrubbing it and getting ready to roast it, as opposed to just having it for dinner when it's already cooked and whatnot, and just seeing the start to finish and seeing that from a young age. And I didn't grow up with that, and I didn't learn most things about where our food actually comes from until I was in my 20s. And so it's very important for me that my daughters and their entire generation has a better understanding of how our food system works than people of, say, like my generation and even older. We're very out of touch with it because food came from boxes and the freezer section and packages and whatnot.
My partner Gary talks about how when he was growing up and his mom was in the kitchen, she just pulled out the oven drawer and had him sit in it. He would play with pots and things and got a little unwieldy, but that was his beginning, learning in the kitchen. So let's talk about some recipes. One that popped out to me are the collie brock tots.
Oh, yes.
Can you talk about it?
Those are similar to tater tots, which are, as you know, a pretty typical kid freezer food. But my version, the main ingredients are cauliflower and broccoli. And it's just a little bit of a different spin on it. There's also chickpeas. So it's a lot, and they're not fried. So it's really just like a little handheld food that I think it's the right size for a lot of kids and adults. I mean, these are delicious. This is by no means a quote-unquote kids' food. This is for the whole family. And just something that's sort of that size that you can dip in a delicious sauce is pretty much always a hit with kids.
Well, finger food is definitely important. You also have roasted stuffed figs, which is genius because figs, I don't know how many people do this in the United States, but combining figs with cheese has been a popular thing over time.
Yes, yeah, that was definitely inspired by recipes I've seen on menus that weren't vegan. And I don't think I'd ever had a vegan version of, you know, a fig and cheese combination before I sort of came up with this one. But my daughter was going crazy over figs the summer before last when I was writing the book. And we're coming up with all sorts of different combinations for it. And that was really the one that we liked the best.
Well, it looks really, really yummy. Okay. And another one that popped out is the macaroni and cheese, the pumpkin stuffed pumpkin mac and cheese. Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the most popular recipe on my blog has been the sweet potato mac and cheese, where the base is a roasted sweet potato, and then there's nutritional yeast and tahini, and that's sort of been a classic. Like, all of my readers who have been with me for a long time know it, and so the pumpkin spin was just a really fun way to present it, and that's within the fall chapter, and since the book is organized by season, I wanted to have this recipe that could really be like a gorgeous centerpiece for a fall party or a Thanksgiving, because it's served within the pumpkin and it just makes it a little bit more fun.
I love stuffing things. So It's just something fun about taking a food like a squash or a pumpkin, which is a squash, or a potato or a sweet potato, or I love those round zucchinis.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of things, vegetables, that you can take the top off, scoop out, fill it with something yummy, bake it, and then serve it. It's just fun.
I agree, and it makes it feel more festive, and if you're having guests over, it just really makes a nice centerpiece. And even if you're not having guests over, if it looks good, it's going to taste that much better right from the get-go.
So we have a wide range of cuisine in the plant-based vegan world, and some people are gluten-free, some people are salt, sugar, and oil-free. Your recipes tend to be, they have oil and sweeteners and salt, but they tend to be low on those things, which is a good choice.
I'm sorry. Well, go on.
I'm done. You said. Tell me about your choice.
I don't, personally, I do eat salt, sugar, and oil. I know some people are not eating those foods. For me, I find eating high quality oils is fine. Salt, you know, I think the quality is really what the big difference is for me. So I'll get Himalayan salt or sea salt as opposed to just table salt, because the salt that has nutritional value, that works for me and for my family. I know some people don't use those, and I think they're pretty easy ways to skip it. But for the most part, I like to, unless I'm having a delicious dessert and I really want to go for it and make something decadent, I don't really want added sugar to my food unless I'm consciously making something that I want to be high in sugar. And so I'll use maple syrup as a sweetener sometimes, or I'll use dates to add something sweet or fruit in a recipe instead of adding sugar, because I don't want to overconsume sugar. I want to save my sugar for a really amazing dessert. And as far as oil goes, I don't overdo it. I guess I just use the amount that feels right, tastes right. And I think getting high-quality, organic, extra virgin olive oil and virgin coconut oil and getting the higher quality types of oils makes a really big difference.
I'm looking at apple almond cookies, and they look great. I haven't made them yet. And they only have a quarter cup of maple syrup, so there isn't a lot of added sugar to it, although it does have some chocolate chips or raisins in them. But here is something that's made with nutritious whole foods, almond flour and spices, an apple, which is naturally sweet, and just a little bit of sweetness, added sweetness, but not too much.
Right. I love this recipe, because if I want to give my girls a treat, you know, I think desserts should be a great part of life, but I don't want to send my 3-year-old into a sugar coma. And I think having recipes on hand that are, they're sweet and they're delicious and it's a beautiful dessert, but they're, you know, not totally overloaded with sugar is really important as a parent. And for myself, I can feel the difference when I eat this type of cookie as opposed to if I eat a bakery cookie that is made with sugar and flour and whatnot. And I'm not saying I don't eat those things, because I do like those from time to time, but if I can make something from whole ingredients and use less sugar that tastes just as good, I would love to do that for when I'm baking at home.
I'm just turning the page here, and there are a lot of great photographs in here, and food photography is so important when you're sharing recipes so people can get an idea and get excited about it. I'm looking at your brown sugar and butternut squash Pop-Tarts, and this must be so much fun for kids.
Yes, I lived off Pop-Tarts as a kid, and I just remember them being the most fun food, and the ingredient list is terrifying, so I don't buy them for my family. I don't even know if they're, what's in them. I'm assuming they're not vegan. It's been so many years since I've had them, but I wanted to be able to make something that was that handheld pastry, cookie, breakfasty type of thing, but the ingredient list is that much better. And this is something that it's a treat, but it could be a breakfasty type of treat.
Well, I'm thinking I have to make this or something like it. And I actually think some Pop-Tarts are vegan. I'm not sure, but I think they are. But I'm remembering what they taste like, and I haven't had one in 40, 50 years. But I can remember the taste. And I'm thinking now I wouldn't like them because they have flavors that I have learned not to like. And, you know, it's a fascinating thing. I'm going to jump off in a different direction for a moment because I'm still thinking about the guest that I spoke with in the first part of the show, where one of the ideas was that we cannot create a vegetarian or vegan world. And so we have to come up with plant meats and cultured meats because that's what people want. And I have a hard time really believing that. I have greater faith in humanity. And I think that it's all about programming and marketing and manipulation. And we're taught to like certain foods because it's surrounded with commercials and imagery, and we're so easy to manipulate. And then there's the salt, oil, and sugar. And I was taught to like a Pop-Tart. And then I had to teach myself and readapt and wean myself off of artificial flavors and sugars and so much sugar, so much sugar, so much oil, and introduce healthier foods. So my tastes have changed. And I wouldn't even like Captain Crunch and Fruit Loops and all those sugary things that I ate as a kid. That sounds awful to me today. So I appreciate your recipe. And I think we can change. I think there is hope to change the palate of Americans and all over the world in terms of what we eat. It's going to be a lot of work, though.
Well, I agree with you. I think once you get those artificial flavors and artificial sweetness out of your system, and then you go back and taste like a fresh apple and how sweet that is, your taste buds recalibrate. And I agree with you. I don't think I would want to eat a traditional Pop-Tart. I don't think I would like it if I took a bite of it now because my palate has changed. And, you know, once you're used to eating these whole foods, these real foods, you just don't respond the same to the artificial things, and it makes you feel terrible. Your body won't feel good after you've had it out of your system for so long. It won't feel good to go back to it. So, yeah, I guess maybe I'm with you. I'm optimistic that people really can change, and I think our palates are changing and our interests in food are changing as a whole.
Well, I just think that the young people today, yourself and your children, are learning more. Now, there are many young people today and old people today that don't know where their kitchen is and they don't want to prepare food and they like convenience, but at least many of them are becoming educated and are looking for foods that they can buy in a store that are prepared or in a restaurant that are less processed, more whole, and more plant-based.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so tell me, I haven't made it, of course, but you have a recipe, brisket-ish.
Yes.
What does it taste like?
So that is a vegetable dish. There's no meat substitute. It's just, well, there's tempeh in it, but I'm not trying to create a recipe that is meaty and tastes like a real brisket, but for me, my family at all the holidays, my grandmother would make brisket and it would have this gravy on it and potatoes and carrots and it was just like warm and cozy meal. And so my goal was to make something that had the essence of my grandmother's brisket. So it has a thick gravy and it's got the vegetables in it and whatnot. And it's not supposed to taste meaty, but it's delicious in a different way that's reminiscent of the original. And that's such an easy recipe because all you do is toss everything with the gravy and then you put it in the oven and then it's done.
I love dishes like that, roasted root vegetables that you put in the oven. You might splash balsamic vinegar or some kind of tasty sauce and it's easy and there's something so comforting about them.
Definitely. Those types of root vegetables, foods that grow in the ground, are literally grounding to our bodies, and eating those types of foods this time of the year just feels so good. And it feels as if your grandmother is making you a meal. It's got that sort of homey, comforting essence.
Okay, I'm looking at the jackfruit Reuben. which is made with red sauerkraut. Do you make your own, or do you get it from somewhere?
I do. I love to make sauerkraut. I also buy it in the store sometimes because I like to try different sauerkrauts that are out there, but I really enjoy making it at home because it's so easy. Cabbage is not an expensive vegetable, and after you get the technique down, it's kind of difficult to mess up, and so I love making sauerkraut at home. I have a recipe on my website for a hot pink sauerkraut, which is what I used in the photo for the jackfruit Reuben, which is why it has that really vibrant pink, and all the hot pink kraut is one green cabbage and one red cabbage made together, and it has this really vibrant color once it starts fermenting.
No, I'm going to have to try that. I do like making cabbage. Definitely. I love red sauerkraut. I mean, I do like making sauerkraut. I like all cabbages, but I love making sauerkraut. It's really easy, and I love it. And I've backed off on how much salt I add because I don't want it to be too salty, and that's one of the nice things about being able to make your own, is you can control what's in it.
Right. Exactly.
All right. I'm thumbing here, doing some more thumbing over these gorgeous photos. And I remember there were a few other things that I wanted to talk about. Oh, hungry. Okay. Let's see. French toast and French toast casserole. I mean, come on.
we love that recipe in my house.
Well, okay, so that's one of the things I'm thinking about. There are a number of recipes in here. There are crisps. Oh, there's this apple dish, and there's a, gosh, I don't have the exact recipes in front of me. There's stewed apples. And there's a poached pear dish in here. And I want people to experience these desserts that are made from fruit, minimal ingredients, easy to make, and are intoxicatingly delicious, as nature intended.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the book is organized by season. And so the apple, stewed apples you mentioned is in the fall chapter, the pear is in the winter. And when you get a fresh apple or a fresh pear at its peak season, it's going to be so sweet and so flavorful that you can really make a delicious dessert that doesn't rely on sugar and chocolate and whatnot. And it can just be so full of flavor. And I think that is something that we forget about because chocolate chip cookies are delicious.
Exactly. Love when I get, it could be a pear. I'm trying to think of some other fruits that I had recently that were ripe. It's important to eat fruits, especially that are ripe, folks. I mean, a lot of times you get a pear. Most of the time when I get a pear in a store, it's hard. It's not ready. It needs to be really soft and custardy-like. But when you get a good quality fruit like that, there is a floral fragrance that comes with it. Mm-hmm, and it's supposed to be there. Which is important because a lot of our industrial foods, tomatoes and fruits, they have no taste.
Right. Unless you're getting it from a farmer's market or growing it in your backyard, I think we forget how delicious a lot of these foods taste when they're fresh.
Yes. Okay, so we just have a few minutes left, tell me, you have The Colorful Kitchen, and that's a blog, along with your, and you also have a cookbook called The Colorful Kitchen. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of The Colorful Kitchen?
Yes, so I started the blog, The Colorful Kitchen, about 6 years ago, and then my first cookbook, which is also titled The Colorful Kitchen, came out 2 years ago. And my new cookbook, The Colorful Family Table, just came out last week. And so it's been a long journey. I would say the evolution from the blog to the cookbook was really me going a little bit deeper into why eating this way is so important to me. And with my new book, I'm focused very much on families and how we can help the next generation eat more colors, be healthier than we are, and treat our planet better than we have. And that's sort of where I'm at now.
Very nice. Well, I recommend people visit your website, and that's thecolorfulkitchen.com?
Yes.
Very good. And take a look at that. I'm going to be checking out your pink sauerkraut recipe. Hot pink sauerkraut.
Yeah.
Excellent. And look into the colorful family table that we just talked about, a number of wonderful seasonal plant-based recipes for the whole family. Thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food.
Thank you so much. This was a great chat.
Okay. Thank you. You're doing important work. Okay, everybody, we have like a minute left. And I want to thank you for joining me. I want to thank you for caring about food. I really believe that we can change this world and nourish everyone and reduce or eliminate chronic diseases today, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, with diet and lifestyle. It's a tough sell. Some people are getting it. We need to share these recipes. We need to make these recipes. We need to put them in people's mouths. And that's our work. And I hope you're making some of these recipes, getting the cookbook, sharing them with people. And the holidays are coming up. This is not a time to be a consumer and buy stuff and give away stuff that we don't need. This is a time to be creative, to be artistic. Maybe you can share recipes or make food and give them to people, something that's nutritious and useful rather than something that's ephemeral and wasteful. Food for thought. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com, where there are loads of free recipes. And check out my blog, What Vegans Eat. Remember, everybody, have a delicious week.